Thanks for listening to Here and Now. We want to know about your experience listening to this podcast, what you like and don't like. If you have suggestions or feedback, send us an email at hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com. Again, that's hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. All day we've been tracking the hostage situation in a cafe in downtown Sydney, Australia. It ended a few hours ago after police stormed the Lind Cafe in Sydney's financial district in the early morning hours Australian time. Seconds later, television viewers watched as apparent victims were carried out on stretchers and in the arms of police. For more than 16 hours, a man identified by Australian police as Iranian-born Man Haran Monis had been holding customers and employees at gunpoint. He's well known to police, with a long criminal record for writing hate mail and being an accessory in the murder of his ex-wife. He was currently out on bail on charges of sexual assault of other women. Clint Van Zandt is the FBI's former chief hostage negotiator. He's been following the situation with us all morning. In fact, Clint, we were speaking with you earlier, right when the shootout began. What were your thoughts then and now about that?
Well, of course, my thoughts at the time were I hoped that the assault force could get in and get to him quickly enough before he had a chance to shoot any of the hostages. But realizing full well that in a situation like that, in the middle of the night with flashbangs going off, with the subject perhaps firing a shotgun, the assault force going in, and a dozen or so hostages perhaps running or crawling on the floor, there was the likelihood that someone else could be injured other than the hostage taker.
But you, very risky, but you were not surprised it was happening when it was happening.
No, if you're going to do something like that, you'd like to go in under the cover of darkness. I mean, law enforcement, or in this case, the Australian SAS, they're special response military team. They really rule the night. They have the night vision capability. They practice on these type of assaults at night. And as you and I may have discussed earlier, they usually have two different plans. One is called a deliberate assault plan, which means if we have lots of time in the daylight and we go in, this is what we're going to do. And then there's the emergency assault plan, which says if we see a hostage go down or if we think the threat level to the hostages has increased dramatically where people are going to start to die, we have to go in this second and we have to know what to do. It looks like it may have been that latter one where under the cover of darkness again, a hostage went down. Whether the hostage was shot or fell, we don't know. But something, there was some catalyst that caused the authority to go in at that moment to try to rescue the hostages that were left inside.
There were some reports from the many reporters who were right there on the scene that there was a hostage down, but that's not been confirmed. And so, you know, we will wait to hear what actually happened. But what is your sense of this overall? Australia raised its terror warning level back in September. We remember that terrible story. They arrested and charged a man with conspiring with an ISIS leader in Syria to behead random people on the streets of Sydney. So there was a raid and people were arrested and one man charged. There obviously had been concerns that someone in Australia would be inspired by or encouraged by ISIS. But then we're hearing about this suspect again. He is a suspect at this point, but who has this long criminal record. What do you make of that?
I think what we're seeing is a new face of terrorism. I mean, we can go back to Bali in 2002, where over 200 people were killed. The attack in Mumbai at various locations where 175 died. The U.S., of course, our 9/11, what we all went through on that. But now what we're seeing is individuals like U.S. Army Major Nadal Hussein at Fort Hood, or the recent shooter at Parliament in Ottawa, or the man who beheaded a woman in Oklahoma, or the individual who attacked New York City police officers with an axe recently. These are the so-called lone wolf somewhat self-inspired individuals who don't have to sit around a campfire or necessarily get on the internet and get direction from anyone else. They're inspired by what they hear, what they see, and without direction, come up with their own plan. And these, for law enforcement, of course, are the most challenging because we have nothing to intersect, nothing to interdict. If there is one person making a plan and he agrees with himself, there's no way for law enforcement to have an informant or somebody like that inside the circle. And an individual like we saw today is fully capable. We see what one person and an easily obtainable firearm, no matter what country, what they can create, the chaos. And know full well, Robin, that there are people, there are terrorist groups and potential lone wolves of the future that have watched this today and that will gain additional inspiration as to what to do and how to do it. Because after all, terrorism is getting up on a stage, pounding your chest, and making the world listen to you. And that's what this man was able to do today.
Well, and also, you know, with that background, allegedly conspired in a brutal murder of his ex-wife, writing hate mail to people there, you know, you throw in, as you told us earlier, potentially mental health issues, and it's a terrible cocktail. Clint Van Zandt, the FBI's former chief hostage negotiator, the FBI very active working with the Sydney police all morning. Clint, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Good to be with you.
We turn to Washington now, where all that's needed to pass the $1.1 trillion budget to fund the U.S. government through September is President Obama's signature. It's been a protracted journey from stalled votes in the House this past week to a long and dramatic weekend session for the Senate. In case you weren't tuned to the Senate's every move over the weekend, fortunately, NPR politics editor Charlie Mattesian was. He is at the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. to tell us what's in the budget and what's not. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Lisa.
So there seemed to be a fair amount of political jousting within parties, especially over the weekend, causing a delay on the vote. Senator Ted Cruz, Republican from Texas, was challenging President Obama's executive action on immigration, but he didn't get so far with his fellow Republicans. What happened?
Well, much of the spectacle this weekend involved Cruz, as you mentioned, who, along with Utah Senator Mike Lee, on Friday scuttled a deal between party leaders, which would have handled the vote on Monday. Basically, what happened was that Cruz demanded that Republicans stop the president's executive action on immigration through a procedural maneuver, and that had the effect of forcing the Senate to return for a weekend session. Now, that's somewhat unusual. The problem, of course, is that many of Senator Cruz's Republican colleagues reacted with anger to the tactic, not just because it caught them off guard and stood to blow up the deal, but because it suddenly presented the prospect that it could allow the president to get more of his stalled judicial and executive branch nominees confirmed, because Republicans had hoped, in essence, to run out the clock on nominations. So that left lots of bad feelings on the Senate floor. Now, keep in mind that the Republicans weren't the only side where we saw some drama. The vote on the measure also revealed some fault lines on the Democratic side, where we saw some of the more progressive members of the Senate, led by Senator Elizabeth Warren, vote no in opposition to their party leadership, in part because of objections to a key provision in the measure that the banking industry wanted.
And in terms of the banking industry and Elizabeth Warren, actually, we want to catch up on Elizabeth Warren in just a second. But first, let me ask you, as this budget now goes to President Obama, what has survived in it? What's in?
Well, when all the dust settles, what we've seen is that the Senate voted to approve a $1.1 trillion deal, which averted the shutdown and funds the government through next September. Next is the president's signature. So what's in the bill? I guess broadly speaking, the legislation provides full funding for 11 of the 12 appropriations bills that Congress is supposed to pass. But it only provides money through February for the Department of Homeland Security, which is the agency, as you know, that has jurisdiction over immigration enforcement. And that's because Republicans plan to design a legislative response to the president's executive action on immigration policy. Now, other things in the bill, among other things, there's money to fight the rise of the Islamic State, $5.4 billion to fight the threat of Ebola. There are significant changes to campaign finance laws and also a provision that weakens the Dodd-Frank Act's restrictions on banks that want to trade in the kinds of derivatives that triggered the 2008 financial crisis.
Let me ask you one thing, Charlie, on that. Both the first two things that you mentioned, fighting ISIS, fighting Ebola, involve the United States military, but military benefits were cut. How come?
Well, I think what you saw was a reflection of the kind of environment that we have in Washington right now, where when it comes to spending, when it comes to military decisions, there's just not a lot of unanimity in terms of what the two parties want, what the factions of the parties want, whether you're talking about the wing that's more concerned with limited spending, or whether you're talking about folks that want to see some sort of different policy when it comes to whether it's fighting the Islamic State or any other theater that we're engaged in.
Okay, let's. I'm sure you were paying attention to the weekend talk shows, and President Dick Cheney was on NBC's Meet the Press talking about the continued reaction, or adding to the reaction, to the Senate Committee's report on torture that was used during the CIA's interrogation of suspected terrorists. So, former Vice President Cheney was told by Chuck Todd. Chuck Todd noted that he's the host of the show, that 25% of the detainees who were interrogated with these methods were later found to be innocent. The former vice president said he doesn't have a problem with that.
It worked. It worked now for 13 years. Mm-hmm. We've avoided another mass casualty attack against the United States. We did capture Bin Laden. We did capture an awful lot of the senior guys of Al-Qaeda who were responsible for that attack on 9/11. I'd do it again in a minute.
Do you see the former vice president's public comments as an attempt to defend his record in office, or something more than that?
Well, I think it was exactly as it appeared, an unrepentant former vice president defending his record and framing it in the understanding that this is a major part of his legacy as a public official. What's notable here is I think this was perhaps the most full-throated public defense that we've heard yet of the CIA's use of torture or harsh interrogation techniques, even though the vice president insisted that it didn't actually amount to torture. And I think the language that Cheney chose was intentionally revealing. By saying things like, I'd do it again in a minute, and reminding of what happened at the Trade Center on 9/11, there's really no room for misunderstanding how Cheney views the morality of the CIA's actions.
Okay, we only have a few seconds left, but tell us briefly about one of the Democrats talked about as candidate for 2016 president, Elizabeth Warren, who told Morning Edition just this morning she's not running. End of story, Charlie?
That's a good question. I think there's lots of folks on the left that are hoping it's not going to be the end of story. There is just lots and lots of interest on the left, particularly within the progressive movement, in a Warren candidacy. She's the figurehead of the wing of the party that has the most energy these days. And I think there are lots of folks on the left that would like to see a challenge like Elizabeth Warren, whether it's to Hillary Clinton or whether it's just having those issues that she raises brought up in the campaign sphere.
Good to get your point of view, as always. Charlie Mattesian, NPR Politics Editor, thank you.
Thanks, Lisa.
A hospital in North Idaho is marketing itself to Canadian tourists, specifically medical tourists. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, Jessica Robinson has the story.
Most of the patients who come into Northwest Specialty Hospital in Post Falls, Idaho, are from the local area, plus a few from Washington and Montana. But hospital CEO Rick Rasmussen is thinking big. Canada big. He pulls up the hospital's website on his computer and shows me the little Canadian flag that was recently added in the upper right-hand corner.
When you click on that, it goes in there. So we have a total knee at 22.5, total hip at 20.
Total knee, total hip, total shoulder, ACL repair, all with the prices listed. These mostly elective procedures have some of the longest wait times north of the border. For example, in Alberta, the typical patient waits 11 months for knee replacement surgery. In British Columbia, it's a year. Northwest Specialty Hospital is offering up what feels more like the listing for a vacation package than a medical procedure. And included in each deal, a stay at the nearby luxury Coeur d'Alene resort.
So the resort picks them up at the airport, them and their spouse, takes them to the hotel, puts them in a nice room overlooking the lake.
And Rasmussen says while the spouse enjoys some spa time, the patient gets a new knee.
And they're back out and playing curling this winter rather than waiting, 2 years.
Northwest Specialty Hospital isn't the only hospital near the border trying to get in on the multi-billion dollar international medical tourism business. A group in Washington is trying to make Seattle a destination. U.S. hospitals may not have the prices that places like Costa Rica, Thailand, and Mexico can offer, but what they do have, at least in the eyes of Canadians, is speediness. Valerie Crooks is a health geographer at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia. She says many Canadians are trying to avoid the wait lists of their national health care system. The demand for knee and hip procedures is especially high with Canada's aging baby boomer population. But Crooks says these aren't vacation getaways. Even when Canadians are just crossing the 49th parallel, she says there are risks.
The practice of Canadians going to the United States for these sort of out-of-pocket payment healthcare arrangements raise some of the similar types of questions as Canadians going to any other country in the world, including sort of lesser developed nations.
Crook says since patients are doing this outside their normal healthcare system, they have to pay and do all their own research. And Crook says even when the procedure goes as planned, the patient's recovery becomes the responsibility of the Canadian healthcare system.
Physicians are left to sort of figure out if and how they're going to follow up on orders that are given from a jurisdiction that is not only not local, but it's coming from an entirely different country.
She says things like physical therapy, medications, and lab tests don't always translate well across the border. Still, many Canadian patients are up for it.
I just Googled knee doctors.
This is Trent Jeffries of Calgary. He went to Northwest Specialty Hospital a year ago. This is even before they officially started the medical tourism program. Jeffries had had knee problems for over a decade, but he says he wouldn't receive approval from his doctor in Canada for knee replacement until he was 55. So with a few years to go and the pain medications no longer working, Jeffries and his wife consulted with an orthopedic surgeon in North Idaho, and they made the 7-hour drive to Post Falls.
Sat down the chair. I wasn't in that chair for 10 minutes, and they called me in for pre-op there.
Jeffrey says he'd never given a hospital a $14,000 check before, but he says it's been worth it.
You know what? To fix the problem, I'd do it again in a heartbeat. It wouldn't bother me a bit. I've said since I've come back that if I have any kind of problems from here on, I won't fool around here. I'll get in my vehicle and I'll drive south.
And he says if there's a stay at a resort thrown in, so much the better. For Here and Now, I'm Jessica Robinson.
And we want to turn back to the big news story of the day out of Sydney, Australia. Heavily armed police storming a cafe and ending a 16-hour hostage standoff that played out in the media. The suspected gunman, Mon Haron Monis, an Iranian refugee and self-styled cleric with a long criminal history, had the hostages call radio DJs. Viewers watched on live television as groups of hostages escaped. Then, after the shootout, they watched hostages be carried out on stretchers and in the arms of rescuers. All of it tweeted out before CNN could catch up. On Monday, we look at stories through the prism of social media. Let's start with this one, which reverberated through cyberspace. Annie Colbert is viral content editor at the news and social media website Mashable. She's at the NPR studios in New York. Annie, what are you seeing out of Sydney?
You know, we're seeing a lot of people want to follow the story through social media because social media updates so quickly. So we're seeing photos, we're seeing reporters on the scene, we're also seeing hashtags emerging like Pray for Sydney. We're also seeing a hashtag I'll Ride With You, which is a hashtag that's pushing tolerance for the Muslim community.
Tell us more about this because it sounds like an incredible story. We've been reading reports that a woman was riding on a bus and noticed a woman who was obviously a Muslim woman. She had a head covering and she started taking the head covering off and the woman spoke to her. What happened?
So this woman shared the story on Facebook about riding the train with what she presumed was a Muslim woman who took off her headscarf. And after the woman got off the train, the woman who's telling the story followed her and told her, you know, don't take it off. You can wear it. I'll ride with you.
And we should say the thinking was that the woman, the Muslim woman, was hearing about the hostage taking and became afraid that she'd be identified, as a Muslim in a negative way.
Right. And so this story started spreading on Facebook. And of course, anything that spreads on Facebook ends up on Twitter as well. And it sparked the hashtag, I'll ride with you. So we're seeing people in Australia share the hashtag saying, you know, this is a thing of tolerance. We want all the Muslim community to feel welcome on public transportation. We see people posting their bus schedules and saying, if you're on this bus, look for me, I'll ride with you.
Well, it's really quite something. A very small Muslim community in Australia, and yet people reaching out to them. We're also seeing tons of reporting on Twitter. We're following a reporter at Channel 7, at Chris Reason 7, because the reporters are right there and tweeting it in time, too.
Yeah, I mean, this is what we see with social media and these big news events now. It used to be the reporter would go, and then later in the day they would file their story, of course, as quickly as possible. But now we see them updating their story as it's unfolding. This is how modern news happens.
Well, so that's the news from Australia through social media. But the same could be said about another story here in the U.S. We saw the march over the weekend, the Justice for All march. This is a story that really in its latest chapter began in Ferguson, Missouri, and grew on social media. But tens of thousands of protesters across the country marched, speaking out against what they saw as police violence after the deaths of Eric Garner and Michael Brown. Here's some sound from the New York City march.
People united will never be defeated.
You saw this on social media?
So we saw not only reporters and journalists from inside posting their Vines and Instagrams live, but we also saw people that were participating sharing their experiences.
The 113th Congress is wrapping up and heading home. It approved a $1.1 trillion budget deal over the weekend. Here to explain how this Congress helped or failed to help our collective economic state is Marilyn Giewacz. She's senior business news editor with NPR, based in Washington now, where she's been following Congress for many years. Marilyn, in terms of the economy, what marks are economists giving this Congress?
Well, it probably won't surprise you to find out that most people are pretty negative about this Congress. But it's the holiday season. I'm going to start out trying to be a little bit generous and focus on the good news. You know, it was a messy process that we saw over this past week, but actually Congress managed to end its two-year session by passing a pretty bipartisan budget. And, compared with the government shutdown, that's actually progress. And there's something else, Lisa, that I really wanted to note, which is that this Congress does deserve something of a hat tip for shrinking the federal budget deficit. If you remember back, during the worst of the Great Recession in early 2009, the federal budget deficit as a percentage of the whole economy, when you measure it by GDP, it was 10%. That's like horrible. It's scary. And in the last couple of years, that deficit has really been melting away. And it looks like in 2015, it'll be down to 2.6% of GDP. If you're wondering, how does that affect your wallet? What does that mean to you? It means that you're in a more stable country. People don't want to invest in a place where the deficit is out of control. And now that we're down to less than the historic averages, that's really pretty good. So
you're giving them light applause for not doing any harm.
A little bit. A slow clap.
A slow clap. But earlier this year, Congress did pass a five-year farm bill. I wonder how that fits in with the overall budget.
Well, that is one thing that, if you were from the agriculture sector, at least if you're a farmer, a rancher, you've got a five-year farm deal that passed, and that renewed a lot of those basic nutrition and farm programs. It also strengthened crop insurance, some livestock disaster assistance. So that was pretty good from the ag sector's point of view. But I'll just toss in a farm joke for you. I'm looking at that as small potatoes. The fact is Congress didn't take on the big issues that businesses were really looking for.
Okay. Good. Not great, but good farm joke. There is of course, coal in the stocking, some bad news for us, too. What issues did the 113th Congress fail to fix?
Well, I think from a business point of view, the thing that a lot of people were concerned about was that corporate tax code. Pretty much everybody who looks at it says something here is really wrong. They need some reforms. The business tax code, it's just too complicated. It encourages businesses to locate overseas. Something's wrong. It needs to get fixed. That didn't happen. And the other thing was, of course, immigration reform. That got all tied up. The president took some executive action, but it really is an unresolved issue. And companies want to be able to hire more high-tech workers. They want to know what the rules are. So that was a big disappointment from a business point of view.
And just briefly, Marilyn, despite the fact that the 113th didn't get to take on some major issues, looks like the economy still did pretty well this past year.
Yeah, actually, that's kind of the weird thing in a way, is that Congress failed businesses on all these things that we talked about, the corporate taxes, the immigration, and of course, they didn't do anything about trade promotion, infrastructure. There are lots of issues that still remain in the coming year. But, you know, today happens to be my sixth anniversary of being at NPR. When I look back at when I came here in December of 2008, think about what the economy was like. Everyone was watching Capitol Hill because it was about bank bailouts and auto bailouts and stimulus. And now, you know, Congress doesn't matter as much because the economy is doing okay.
You have nothing to do with it, but enthusiastic applause for you, Marilyn Juex, on your anniversary. Marilyn's a senior business editor, news editor with NPR. Thanks a lot.
Oh, you're welcome.
Do you have a child who rides the school bus? Is it free? Increasingly, the answer is no. 12 states now allow schools to charge for bus service, and the number is expected to grow. Parents in Indiana filed a lawsuit that's now before the state Supreme Court, arguing that bus fees violate the state's constitutional guarantee to a free education. But state officials across the country point to budget cuts during the recession. And in Indiana, they point to caps on property taxes approved by voters in 2008 that officials say severely cut their revenue. So what are the side effects of asking kids to pay to travel to public schools? Mike Griffith is senior policy analyst for the Education Commission of the States. That's a nonprofit, nonpartisan group that helps states form policy. Mike, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
How hot a topic is this for states, this idea of charging kids to ride a bus?
It's become a big topic in states now because of the recent recession that we went through. We saw a lot of cutbacks in education, and one of the ways that districts tried to balance their budget was by either cutting back on transportation or starting to charge a fee for it to students.
And what about the argument? Your group is a neutral on this issue, but the argument that's being made is that there's a constitutional guarantee of education, and part of that guarantee is being able to get to the education. What's the debate on that?
So the debate is part of a larger debate on fees in general. Mm-hmm. And transportation fees are part of that, but there's also districts that charge for fees for supplies, for textbooks, for other services in schools. And people say, you know, if a student can't get to a school, if a student can't afford the textbooks or the supplies, then you're kind of taking away the definition of a free education. And so what we've seen is parents start to become upset with that, but local policymakers push back and say, we either have to charge a fee for these services or we just can't provide them. We just don't have the funds to do that. And so we've seen both things happen.
Well, you mentioned the various things that schools are doing. It gets very complicated, and a lot of it is summed up in the Indiana case because there was a previous Supreme Court case in which the state's highest court determined a $20 fee at that time in one district did violate the constitutional guarantee of education. But this parents group that's now launched the current lawsuit says they want to go beyond fees. Even though a prior court said fees were illegal in one district, they want to add you can't even can discontinue a service.
And that sounds very good on the surface, that you're mandated now as a school district to provide busing services to all those students who require it. But what, again, the counter from the school districts is that they don't have sufficient funds right now to do that. And if you're going to force them to do that, they're going to have to make other cuts. And the majority of spending in education goes to teacher salaries and benefits. So if you're going to force them to provide busing services, they're probably going to have to look at eliminating teaching positions. So it's one of these situations where, you know, you win on one side as a family who now you're able to have your son or daughter picked up by the bus, but you lose on the other side because once they get to school, they'll have fewer services available to them.
Well, the ACLU brought a case against the state of California a couple of years ago, charging that it is unconstitutional for public schools to charge fees for educational activities and materials. This is what you were talking about, textbooks and such, and things like sports. They want a settlement, but what happens with court cases like that, these little ones across the country? How are they being used as precedent or not?
So what we're seeing is more and more, again, especially because of the recession and because school districts felt that they had no other way to find funding for education, they started to move more and more towards fees. And what happened in California is they were charging fees for a whole host of activities within a school. And in some cases, those were activities that students needed to participate in to graduate. So language classes they had to buy, they had to pay for their own textbooks or their own learning material. And there were registration fees for certain courses, and there were lab fees and so forth and so on. And the parents finally said, this is enough, and they took it to court. And what the state did is settle out of court, essentially, and say, look, we understand it's gone too far at this point. And they sent letters to every school district saying, you cannot charge for fees that are mandatory for a student to attend school. But we're seeing that in school districts across the country. And quite frankly, it's understandable why parents are upset, because it takes away the definition of a free education. Some school districts actually charge now just to register for a school year,
which is, again, a constitutional guarantee, public school. What do you think is at the heart of this? The state officials say that there are cuts. And also, we see at least one state, people are voting against things like property taxes, which support education. Do the taxes have to be raised? Do officials have to be more careful with their cuts? I mean, what's at heart here?
So we're seeing sort of three things that happen at the same time. And I always hate this term, perfect storm, but that's sort of what we're in. First off, we had a movement in the past sort of 15 years or so, where states started to cap local property taxes. So school districts in many states cannot raise the amounts that they'd want to, even if their voters wanted to do that. Second off, the recession hit, and we saw state funds decrease. So we saw the tax cap limited the amount of local funds available. The recession decreased the amount of state funds available. And we're seeing higher and higher standards in schools across the country, putting more pressure on school districts to, you know, help students learn. So they're seeing higher cost in school districts with lower available local and state dollars. And the only other alternative revenue source is something like student fees for different activities.
Yeah. How are states that are doing this, how are they handling the families that really can't afford it?
So most provide a waiver on these fees for students who qualify for free and reduced price lunch. But, you know, to put that sort of into perspective, you can be a single parent with two children making $37,000 a year, and you would not qualify for free and reduced price lunch. So not only would your son and daughter not get a free lunch program, you might have to pay for bus services, for textbook fees, for supply fees. That can be a pretty big burden on a single parent.
That's Mike Griffith, senior policy analyst for the nonprofit, nonpartisan Education Commission of the States. They work with states forming education policies. Mike, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
And we have this quick note about a video that's gone viral in just 2 days. On Saturday, actor Samuel L. Jackson posted a clip on his Facebook page calling on celebrities who participated in that ALS fundraiser, the Ice Bucket Challenge, to now join him in another action to sing in protest of the choking death of Eric Garner by a white police officer. Jackson called out for others to sing along with this song.
I can hear my neighbor crying, I can't breathe. Now I'm in the struggle, and I can't leave. Calling out the violence of the racist police. We ain't gonna stop till people are free. We ain't gonna stop till people are free. Come on, sing it out.
Actor Samuel Jackson making that appeal on his Facebook page. And Lisa, so far he's gotten over 2 million views.
And our listeners can see that video at hereandnow.org. Now, we leave you today with something in keeping with the season.
Rudolph the red-nosed reindeer had a very shiny nose.
Who doesn't know that song about Santa's red-nosed friend? But what's less known is that this tune was written by a Jewish composer. In fact, many Christmas classics were penned by Jews. Now, one Jewish musician in New York has looked at the ambiguous relationship that many Jews in America have with Christmas, and he's made a musical out of it. Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd has spoken with a man about the music and about the legacy that he's part of. Peter?
That's right, Lisa. I spoke to Stephen Blyer. He's the co-founder of the New York Festival of Song, and he's the arranger of A Goyisha Christmas to You. And I started off by asking him what other Christmas music had been written by Jews.
Oh, well, of course, White Christmas, Santa Baby, The Most Wonderful Time of the Year, lots of the really famous ones. 12 of the 25 most popular Christmas songs were written by Jews.